There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is September 24th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyekehaka, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
See, wait. Fan roof. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
First, news. Cities across the globe marched this afternoon to call on world and provincial leaders to combat climate change. Montreal's demonstration went through Jean Mons Park. The Liberal Party of Quebec and representatives from the community group Solidarity Across Borders were among the crowd. And voters weighed in on federal government seats during the election last weekend. The Liberal Party maintained their minority government, leaving Justin Trudeau as prime minister for his third term.
If you voted for our party, thank you. Thank you for putting your trust in our team to keep moving forward for everyone. And if you did not vote for us, I want you to know that we will stand up for you and work for you every single day.
Most boroughs on the island elected Liberals, while most suburbs voted Bloc Québécois. One riding on the island, La Pointe-à-l'Île, voted for the Bloc, and Rosemont-La Petite-Patrie re-elected their NDP representative. Election day included long waits for Montrealers that sometimes wrapped around multiple blocks. City residents will return to the polls to vote for mayoral seats on November 7th. And the province passed a ban on Thursday restricting COVID-19-related protests within 50 meters of schools, daycares, and hospitals. Officials passed it within one day. The ban applies to any message related to COVID, whether protesters want increased ventilation in schools or no mask mandates for children. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But no, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
Pop Montreal International Music Festival is celebrating its 20th anniversary from September 22nd to 26th, 2021. 5 days of music, films, art, crafts, panels, and more, featuring Cakes Tequila, Backwash, The Besnard Lakes, The Deers, Handsome Eli, and more. Tickets on sale now at popmontreal.com.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. The Montreal-based Welcome Collective released a guide for refugee claimants this week. It's a group that voluntarily helps pair new families claiming refugee status with the local people who help with orientation. You can find a copy of their new 500-page welcome guide on Facebook. Search Collective Bienvenue. We're also going to share the air with producers Elephant in the Room. Their September 21st episode talks about refugee resettlement situations across borders and within the European nation. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some local news that you can use.
Elephant in the Room is an anarchist radio show from Dresden, Europe, where we talk with activists from all around the world about politics, life and universe. Airing every second and fourth Monday of the month on Color Radio. You can find the podcast version of the show on the Channel Zero Network or on your favorite podcast platform. From activists for activists.
The band sounds great.
Hello and welcome here by Elephant in the Room. It is Monday, surprisingly. And yeah, not so good news for today. Yesterday, at least three people died, or actually four, were found dead on the Polish border to Belarus. The assumption right now is that people died because of hypothermia. And three people were found on the Polish border side, and one woman was found on the Belarusian side. And all four seem to be from Iraq. And at least this is the sources of the media we have right now. And we're going to talk about how actually it could happen that now also on the EU border to Eastern Europe, people are dying. But before we're going to start with that, we will listen to some music. So the news came actually late yesterday, and before we go deeper in actually the recent incidents, we would like to frame the whole situation for everybody who didn't really recognize or noticed what was going on on the border in the last month. So yeah, as I mentioned already, it's the border to Belarus, and Europe and Belarus has actually a kind of a special relation concerning this kind of acknowledgement as partners. It's kind of an alternating relationship, I would say. The European Union always tries to find a way actually to deal with Lukashenko. Then Lukashenko often does his dictator things, like being authoritarian, violating human rights and stuff like that. And then the relationship changes. In 2004, Poland and the Baltic countries like Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia became member of the European Union. And that means that the European Union border shifted to more east, means to Belarus. And yeah, with this, the whole relationship between the European Union and Belarus, of course, changed. Maybe we can talk about a little bit about that at the beginning, how could we kind of define or explain the relationship between European Union and Belarus since actually that situation?
Well, cooperation between EU and Belarus started before 2004. And this was in the terms of a collapse of the Soviet Union. So when the Soviet Union collapsed and all the republics started falling apart, the Western capitalist enemies of communism, people would call it in the Soviet Union, started flooding the countries to do the economical reforms. You could see like the shock doctrine applied in Russia. The same was trying to be pushed in Belarus and in Ukraine and in the other countries. So this was part of like a general Western approach towards the collapsing Eastern Bloc. And there, for example, the first presidential elections were highly influenced by this kind of like a new Western type of campaigning and people, the experts on the campaign. And Lukashenko, for example, was elected with one of the experts who was like highly trained by the American system of elections and all this like a really polarized Democratic Republican Party bullshit. But then the partners that were there for European Union before Lukashenko started losing their power, and in general the power started like in the 90s in Belarus drifting from one part to another when Lukashenko was trying to consolidate the power in his own hands and build up like a dictatorship that he has right now. And part of it was the destruction of the parliament that had quite a big part, I think it was a majority actually, who was not supporting Lukashenko. So although he was a president in 1994, still the parliamentaries were elected that were like confronting his power. And later on, when the power started, like the second re-elections in 2001 were already questionable for the European politicians and were, I think, not acknowledged by European Union. And then further you go, every election round is always not acknowledged by the European Union. But this doesn't mean that the European politicians would be like, you are false president, you were not elected, we are not going to talk to you. Rather, it's a political game. So they wouldn't acknowledge the elections, but they are still creating the programs that would be working with Lukashenko and again Lukashenko and not any other presidential. Meanwhile, Belarusian opposition for a really long time has connections with the European Union, with the European Union foundations, with American foundations also, starting like from conservatives to like progressive liberals or whatever you call that. And they are, through some foundations, funneling money into Belarus, trying to bring down Lukashenko, who knows that. So for him, the Western countries are still in the paradigm of this kind of like an old Soviet Union one, where there is West and East, and West is always trying to undermine your authority. And then there is Lukashenko, who is trying to stay in power. However, Lukashenko understands that he was and is between two fires, between Russia that is trying to bring as much influence in Belarus as possible through economical, social, political, media, and many other ways that are there. And there are a lot of connections historically, like the Soviet Union did a lot to make Belarus as a Russian zone of influence. So Lukashenko understands that there's this threat from East, from Putin, from Moscow for his independence, for his like power. And that's why historically he was trying to balance between Moscow and Brussels, or between Moscow and Berlin, or whatever you call it, where the political power is in Europe. And everybody understands that. That's the game that he plays, and everybody's like understands the game and tries to figure out how to work with him. Putin, for example, hates Lukashenko because he's super unreliable. Whatever deals they're making, he's changing in a year or two. Although in public, you don't see like Putin, you know, hitting Lukashenko in the back like a small brother or whatever. Rather, they're smiling and they're partners and whatever. But in reality, these two dictators hate each other because Putin wants to absorb Belarus and kind of integrate it into Russia with more economical and social ties. And Lukashenko wants to stay a dictator. And although they have this union state, it is still like it's hard to have a union state with two dictators because they will fight with each other. Who will be the dictator of a union state? So Europe understands that, and they are like, apart from just financing opposition, are always sitting on the table with Lukashenko and talking to him and figuring out like, hey, if you like soften your dictatorship and you play by the rules, then everything will be fine. So, for example, in 2010 election round or re-election round, the European politicians came to Minsk and said, well, if you play like the whole election campaign by the rules of the liberals, maybe we'll give you like credits and money and fame and all you want and fancy cars and going to Austria skiing. It's going to be glorious. And that's what they were selling. And he was like really happy with that until the moment the big protest happened in 2010. And then Lukashenko went crazy, beat up everybody. And that was the end of cooperation for that short moment. Right? Publicly. That's an important part because while the European politicians were condemning the violation of human rights in the dictatorship of Belarus, for reality, for example, taking Germany, the cooperation was still going on. So people were put, like there were political prisoners, 50 political prisoners in 2010-11. The Germans were still working with the Belarusian police, training them, passing them equipment. Like there is a number that came up, I think in 2011, that between 2008 and 2011, Ministry of Internal Affairs of Germany passed 20 million euro to Belarusian police in equipment, but also in money and in trainings and so on and so forth. And this was one part of cooperation, so the police cooperation and security, so-called. And the other part of cooperation was, of course, as you mentioned, moving the border of European Union had to bring those two countries or two like political powers to the table to talk about how they're going to work on the borders. And this was done also in connection with this horrible thing that is called Frontex that was pushing quite a lot the cooperation with Lukashenko. Doesn't matter if he's a bad dictator who is violating human rights, the border should be protected. And they were counting a lot also in 2012, 2013, while the sanctions of European Union were rolling against Lukashenko's regime. The Frontex was working with Belarus on increasing the security of the Belarusian borders.
What did that mean exactly? Like increasing? Like I remember when the European border was still between Germany and Poland, there was, for example, on the German side, a lot of kind of measurements, a lot of police, a lot of surveillance technique, and not as developed as we have it right now, but quite huge. And eventually before Polish-Belarusian border was more kind of fluent, so people had closer connections, could move here and there. So how can we imagine that? What was the Belarusian side? How looked the Belarusian side back then, and then how the Polish side?
I think one part is of cooperation is about making deals, saying, hey, you're going to protect your border, we are going to protect our border, and everybody protects their borders, so no illegal immigrants are going through. So this was one of the things. The other thing was that they had like joint trainings, and the Frontex actually invited Belarus border guards in 2014 to Warsaw while still the sanctions were on, and the political prisoners were still like traded between Belarus and European Union. Belarusian border guards were sitting there and learning from Frontex how to properly protect the European borders, because they're not talking about protection of the whole border system of Belarus, but rather like specific region. And then they were giving money. I think between 2014 and 2016 or 17, there were around 80 million euros like passed to Belarus to develop the border, the border protection system and so on and so forth. So all of that shit was happening on a regular basis, kind of ignoring the politics. So for them, it was, as I said before, it doesn't matter with whom we cooperate. It is really important to protect what doesn't matter what it means, right? The protection of the borders. But for them, it was really important to kind of eventually encourage to do the repression of border protection, or put the responsibility of that on Belarusian side. So they did not need to build up these walls like the crazy Trump with his fucked up south wall. The European Union wouldn't have to build up these walls, wouldn't have to install all the crazy equipment, rather saying, hey, Belarusian country, please, can you do this and this and that? And for a really long time, for example, for people, it was quite hard if you're from Egypt or you're from Middle Africa or from like the hot zones like Syria, it was quite hard to get to Belarus in general. So to get a visa and then fly to Minsk and then do something, this was like a really hard route. And this was also a result of this policy making of the European Union. So they would try to prevent refugees traveling through Belarus by enforcement of this kind of don't let them come in to Belarus.
I remember being at the border several times, and a lot of people from Chechnya actually were as well there and tried to cross, but eventually was not, at least not all of them were allowed to pass. I guess this is already some like 6-7 years ago. And this seemed to happen on a kind of intense scale that people really eventually really reach the border and try to enter, but were not permitted. What happened to people who tried to cross actually to Europe and didn't have a visa? What did Belarus do with this, with the people?
I think, first of all, it's important to understand that as a European or as a Westerner who's traveling between the in the world and you are like super mobile and everything is working pretty well, for a person coming from a second world or a third world, you need quite a lot to get the visa. You need like quite a lot of papers. You have to prove that you're financially successful and all this shit. So every time you go to the embassy, they look at you as if you're like an illegal immigrant until you prove otherwise. And it doesn't matter if you're Belarusian or you are from Mozambique or you are from Ukraine and whatever. Changed recently for Ukraine though. So this kind of like attitude was pretty much shutting down European Union for really big amount of people. And then when you're traveling to European Union, and I think this comes also from a certain agreements between the countries, Belarusian border guards would check if you have a visa to enter European Union. Now they're not doing that anymore, but before they would do that and they would ask you like, hey, what are you going to do? Why don't you have visa? And you are going like, might be that they will say, no, you're not allowed to go to Poland or to Lithuania. The situation with the Chechnya refugees was a little bit special as you mentioned, they were traveling to Poland, and originally through all this asylum seekers application and regulations, actually the Polish border guards have to accept the request for the asylum from Chechnya asylum seekers. But what was happening is that from one side, Belarusian guards, border guards were allowing them to go without visa to Poland, but Polish border guards would not accept the asylum. And they would just put the asylum seekers back on the train and send them back to Belarus. And this was happening not 6 years. I think it's happening at least 12 years already. And speaking to some refugees from Chechnya that were trying to get to Poland, they said it's kind of like a gamble. It's like a casino because they're letting maybe like 1-2 families per month. And without any kind of a clear understanding of the system. So they decide today that this family can go and this family can go. And that created quite a crazy situation where in Brest, where the Chechnya Chechen refugees are passing, there is like a small infrastructure of those people actually living, and like a really fucked up people are actually predatoring on them, passing the rooms in the flats for incredible amount of money and all the shit. But this is happening for 12 years. So for at least 12 years, Polish border guards are basically violating all these refugee conventions, and nobody cares about that from both sides, from all the directions. Yeah, so this is one of the examples how the system was not working even before. Like, nobody cared about the refugees. And I mean, Chechnya is a fucking horrible place, just to say. And the people who are standing there at the borders of the European Union in Poland or Lithuania, they have no fucking clue what to leave in the, how to leave in Chechnya, and what are the conditions of life there. So they have, like, from my perspective, no fucking moral rights to say no or yes or maybe or whatever they're doing actually to the people there.
Know you take people, lock them up forever on some brute, lethal fear campaign, bureaucratic mental bricks of rhetoric and blame. For the folks off the boat seeking freedom from stripes and human rights, why else would they be risking their life? All I know is it's outrageous when courageous sons and daughters crossing waters now living in cages for ages, waiting while we conversating, arguing, debating on what's the real Australian or who's just faking or not assimilating more. Who's on the roof, hunger striking till their life abort? While circle goes berserker with their pepper spray, politicking politicians wishing it would go away, but the issue sustains as long as people do manage to escape the weight of a dictator's boot, to be processed and held hostage by attitudes. We all vote deeper than less indigenous group, many whom still treated like refugees on their own land. Intervention down under and underhand, it ain't just here, we know it's many places. True. Plenty worse, serving up a racist matrix, claiming case review on an individual basis, feeding prison CEO individual pay slips as days rip to years on the calendar, tension builds and builds till Christmas becomes a Attica. So add it up, we got enough space here to house a bit more action, compassion and less tears before the overseers, equating life with the lotto, indiscriminate, indeterminate, incommunicado be the motto of the policy employed, but that ain't good enough for our future to be enjoyed. How about we take people, welcome them like we would want next sequel, balance like the equinox. The truth is lethal for the ones who want it caged up, placed behind barbed wire, wired up with that same old hate, evil, xenophobic, paranoia. Take people, lock them up forever on some root, lethal fear campaign, bureaucratic mental bricks of rhetoric and blame. Though we all equal, rarely does it manifest when more people living under mad oppression, fenced in, denied their request, for the wicked no rest, nor for us to protest.
System fold for no more.
we were talking about the situation in on the like the relation between Belarus and European border, and how actually the border regime was enforced in the sense that European Union was giving money and eventually to encourage Belarus to protect European Union in the sense that they were not supposed to let refugees inside. And you said they really got actually a lot of money. And I thought they were actually supposed to build even camps to put refugees inside. How was actually the situation? The people who were pushed back from the border or who were not supposed to let to the EU, did they had a chance to get asylum in Belarus? Were people staying in Belarus, or were people actually put in camps? Did Belarus build camps, or how can we imagine the situation actually back then?
Well, Belarus doesn't have a working asylum system at all. It did sign all these agreements on the asylum seekers and so on, and it's part of the United Nations and all this formal things. But in reality, to get an asylum in Belarus, you have to dance really hard, and it's a really like dozens of people. Really dozens of people. Even when the whole war in Ukraine happened with Russian invasion and all the stuff, and Ukrainians from the war region went to Belarus in dozens of thousands, they were not giving them asylum status at all. Like, the people were legalized through different other, let's say, political and bureaucratic systems. And I was like, at some point in the office, in the migration office, at the point in the same room where the Ukrainian refugee was trying to apply for their asylum status, and the fucker who was sitting across the table, the cop that was processing him, said, no, you don't have any case here because there is no official war in Ukraine. Like, nobody declared war on Ukraine, so you're not going to get asylum. And I think that this shows like the whole approach towards the migration in Belarus. And if you are a migrant and you're trying to apply to get asylum, and the police decides, okay, you don't have enough legal reasons to stay in Belarus, they will put you in prison, and they are not going to go through your papers and give you asylum or say no to asylum and then deport you. Rather than Belarusian system, the Belarusian migration system works in the way that you actually have to you have to pay for your own deportation. So people who are in the status also of asylum seekers can stay up to several years in this short-term arrest prisons that are built actually for like a short-term arrest, and they're not made for a longer stay. They can stay there for so long until they figure out money. And it can be like the family finds the money and then pays the Belarusian state so he can or she can fly out, or the person can work inside of the prison and earn like really little money and then leave the country on his or her own. So this is like the situation that people are facing. Nobody's going to Belarus to apply for asylum. Although I think 2 years ago there was a case of one person from Turkey who escaped to Belarus, and he was actually planning to go further on through Belarus to some European country. And Turkey was searching him for connections with PKK, and Belarus arrested him. He applied for asylum. He was in prison for, I think, 4 or 5 months, and then deported to Turkey without legally the whole procedure went like he went through one court, second court, third court, and everything was like legally processed. But in reality, it was just like a formality, and they sent him back to Turkey where he was I don't know what happened to him, but most probably later on prosecuted as well in the criminal case. Yeah. So Belarus is not a safe place to go. Oh, no.
Okay. You already mentioned before that, like we talked about, that the relation between EU and Belarus is changing a lot. And in 2015, Lukashenko released the political prisoners from 2010, because 2015 there were new re-elections. And after he released the political prisoners, European Union decided, hey, let's be partners again. You seem so liberal and now you're doing proper elections. And so kind of a normalization of the situation. Now, in 2020, surprisingly, there was a huge uprising and European Union again figured out that Lukashenko has some issues with human rights, and the European Union was again concerned about the violation of human rights and condemned the action of Lukashenko. So we all know that there were some kind of minor sanction against certain people applied right now from European Union, and Lukashenko was not so happy with that, and or at least it seems like that he's not so happy. So his approach towards Europe changed again, and he kind of didn't like the hostile relationship right now, and actually changed specifically his refugee politics. Let's get into that a bit.
I think like what is happening right now, or change in the border protection doctrine in Belarus, is actually not the first time. In 2012, something similar already happened. And back then, Europe was also applying sanctions against Belarus for having political prisoners, for imprisoning like over 50 people. And there it worked pretty successful. So the idea was actually to press European Union into cooperation. And then later on in 2015, everybody were happy that Lukashenko is back on the table of the Eastern Partnership. So this worked somehow. And nobody was creating such a big fuss right now, like right now, from Polish government or from the Lithuanian government and so on and so forth. So this is what was happening before, but was transformed right now in a different way, because also you have to take into account that back in 2012, the Polish government was still like a liberal coalition or whatever, and Lithuania was also ruled by like a centrist conservatives. And this changed right now. So now Lithuania is ruled by the new right-wing government. Poland is just like authoritarianism growing up on steroids. And this is giving both countries the card to play on the table of this kind of a migrant refugee hysteria that was happening before. And that was giving more, let's say, political power to the right wings in their hysterical approach towards like, oh, we are getting overflooded. In reality, what is happening is that there are, I don't know, in case of Lithuania, several thousand migrants and refugees who cross the border. In Poland, it's also like several thousand people. So it's not even on the scale of like, I don't know, a big migration wave, like even not on the scale of Belarusian migrants crossing the border to Poland, to Lithuania, to Ukraine. However, here for the right-wing government, this is really an important point where they can use and say, oh, this is like the war happening right now.
I'm not sure if the comparison is really valid, but I felt like reminded on Erdogan's politic in the sense of putting pressure on Europe and the question of migration. Like, if you don't give me money, then I'm not gonna protect the border, as we could see last year. I don't know. No, it was before Corona. It's already 2 years ago when Erdogan let a lot of Syrian refugees pass at some point and said, yeah, the border is open now. And then there was also this kind of war on refugees with shooting and putting gas on them and letting them kind of don't give them food, and they were kind of in this in the middle. between Europe and, or between Greece back then and Turkey. Would you say that this kind of is a kind of a valid comparison right now, that Lukashenko tries to figure out something similar?
I think what is important here is Lukashenko is not inventing new things, and his advisors are also not inventing new things. And European Union is making really clear with all the money that they're throwing on the questions of migration where it hurts. So both for Erdogan, Lukashenko, Putin, whoever is sitting at the European borders, it is pretty clear that European Union is afraid of refugees, which is a bizarre concept for, like, if you think about the liberal values and liberal philosophy. And through all these years of this kind of like a border cooperation and so on and so forth, it became clear that this is one of the most important things that the European Union wants from Lukashenko. And this is one of the topics that are like forcing Europe to talk to dictator. Like, he doesn't have anything special, you know, and the things that they are asking for are most probably are special for European Union, so you can play them. Yeah, and that's why they are trying to use it for their own like benefits. However, the system have changed quite a bit, and also the system changed for Lukashenko. Erdogan is a friend of, in certain way, of Germany, which is like the biggest economical and political power in European Union. And Lukashenko has no friends. Like, he's a friend of Putin. Of course, there are like lobbyists that are working for Lukashenko, that are working for Putin, and both of them are like trying to help Lukashenko in his struggle against the sanctions. But for Lukashenko, current game is not giving any good results. Like, the more he's trying to press European Union into cooperation on the question of migration, and then back on the table where the money will flow back to Belarus, and like acknowledge him as a president, the more European Union is fighting back. And that's interesting thing that you could see like in the last year, that the protests in Belarus and the repressions and the murder and the torture and the big waves of migration didn't actually moved European politicians to the extent that they're like, oh, we have to like start acting here and now. Sure, they passed like some law that would give like millions of euros to some opposition, typical thing, right? But when Lukashenko started doing this game with the refugees, allowing like opening the borders and also landing the airplane, the Ryanair plane, not Lufthansa or something like posh, right? A shitty Ryanair. That hit him like in this cooperation, in this attempt to get back to the European Union. And it kind of like closed the door for the next years for sure.
For everybody who is not really aware, the situation actually is on since April this year. That even so, before you said that people, it was not so easy to fly to Belarus for people, it seemed like a little easier in the last months for people to come from Iraq, for example, or other countries to Belarus. So people would fly in with the airplane, and then they could pass actually to the European borders. So as you mentioned, several thousand people, like this were not, they were not all in one day, rather than distributed over, like as I said, it started already in April. People would go to the European border, and at some point Polish and Lithuanian, Latvia noticed that, okay, they're right now coming a lot of people who would like to enter. How actually did the situation develop in the way that we have now people dying actually in the border?
Well, I think what was happening is, again, the result of European policies in first place, that the European Union is, with its Frontex bullshit, heavily dependent on authoritarian countries to protect its borders against refugees. We're not talking about like invasion of Russia of Russians or Russian army or Turkey doing some military shit. We're talking about protection against refugees, which is like a complete crazy bullshit. And this policy is just bringing you to the extent that you are fucked when the authoritarian government is not cooperating. And then what do dictators do? I mean, they're escalating the situation to the extent that people start dying. Conservative regimes in Poland and in Lithuania are also not the best example of, you know, dealing with the not the best example of the government dealing with a humanitarian crisis. So one thing, right, the European Union fucking up the policy on the migration for a really long time. The other thing is the local authorities, the Polish and Lithuanian government, is incapable of understanding what refugees are and where people are coming from in that specific case, because at the same time, the Belarusian refugees are accepted both in Lithuania and in Poland. And this is like an example of an extreme hypocrisy where basically like the color of the skin is defining your refugee status, which is unacceptable. I'm not talking about some bullshit formalities in United Nations and accepted by any moral standard. Like, you do not help person based on his skin color or the language he speaks. Rather, you help the person in need. And so that's one of the things that they're kind of like really splitting. Oh, this is Belarusian migrants, Belarusian refugees. They're good. And this is people are coming from Iraq, Afghanistan, and some, I don't know, Congo or some other countries. And they're bad ones. And here for the bad ones, the case, for example, with Lithuania is that they are saying that they are not refugees. Rather, they are working for Lukashenko. They are like part of this sophisticated plan of Lukashenko to build up pressure on European Union. And this is another bizarre part. Of course, people are used by Lukashenko, and we see that he's using the whole refugee crisis or refugee crises happening all around the world for his own benefit. But at the same time, like, they are still refugees. They're still human beings. And the both Polish and Lithuanian government denies to treat them in any human way, actually.
So eventually what we see is that people were pushed back.
Yes, this is what happens both again in Lithuania and Poland. In the first months, people were accepted in the region, and the Lithuanian border guards were freaking out because the Belarusian border guards wouldn't stop the refugees passing the border, or they would even like report some cases where the Belarusian border guards would point the direction for the refugees to go into the European Union. And recently, I think the Lithuania legalized the pushbacks in July. There, the concept was that as long as Belarus is waging this thing that they call hybrid war, which is basically like refugees crossing the border to European Union, as long as this happens, the refugees are seen as a combatants in the hybrid war. So they are combatants for Belarus in this war. And that's why they're not supposed to be processed through all the legal procedures that the refugees are supposed to go through. And that kind of allows them to kick out people out of the country even when they're coming and asking for asylum. So they're not getting anything in that direction. And this was passed by the majority in the Lithuanian parliament. And in Poland, with the pushbacks, as I mentioned about the Chechen, for example, refugees, they were doing that for a really long time. Everybody were ignoring that. And now with the state of emergency that they passed recently, this also legalized pushbacks for them. And they basically closed the borders. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the same goes actually also for Latvia, which also is now in the state of emergency because of this kind of situation. Zagranica! the situation of the people who would like to cross the border to Poland or Lithuania eventually ended up right now in this situation that they try to cross, but they are pushed back. We just heard that pushbacks are legalized in Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland right now through different political means, like emergency state or specific laws. And this leads to the situation that the people are actually stuck between the borders in the place where there's nothing. There's maybe a river and the forest, and people can't go back or forth. They are actually, the situation was that people were, that border guards were shooting at them to push them back from both sides. People don't have food right now. Even so, we just passed summer. It turns out to be really cold in the night, also during the day. And people are right now kind of captured or kind of locked in this kind of this small space between the borders. Do we have any idea how many people are still stuck there? Do people go eventually? Is there a possibility to go back? Did people receive any kind of help on the Belarusian side?
Well, the story is quite complicated again. We don't know how many people are right now at the border in the neutral zone. It seems like the point that brought quite a lot of media attention is gone, like where there was around 20 people or something like that with families. Right now, there are no places where people would get, like, be sitting there and camping and so on and so forth, rather than people would be crossing the border in the places. And the more European Union is consolidating its powers and bringing more military, more Frontex forces, the more desperate people are in crossing the border. So, for example, some people are crossing the Belarusian swamps on the border, and this is something that a lot of people from south do not comprehend the danger of, that you can easily drown in the swamp. I think Germans also didn't know back in the Second World War. So people don't know that, and some people are dying there in the swamps. And what happened with this three dead refugees that they were talking about, that they found their bodies. And it is unclear, like, what is going on right now at the borders and how many people are, like, dying, drowning, freezing. The borders are for sure patrolled from both sides, but the Belarusian side is also making it pretty clear that they don't want to get the people back. So those people who decide to go to Poland or Lithuania will have some troubles coming back. But it changes as well pretty rapidly, depending on the mood of Lukashenko or depending on the conversations he had with some other people. It is pretty clear that the European Union is actually trying to build up pressure on Lukashenko through Moscow. So through conversations with Putin, and the Putin is saying, okay, maybe now it's like not the best time what you're doing. And shit like that. So this happens. And yeah. So there are no, like, people stuck in the neutral zone right now. But this is, like, can happen at any moment in time, like it was before.
No.
Where people wouldn't get help actually from Belarusian side, and the Polish side wouldn't give them any help, but also would not allow help from NGOs, like from migration NGOs and so on, that are existing in Poland.
Yeah, so now when we see pictures actually that the European border in Lithuania and Poland is kind of fenced with this
barbed wire
in like three lines. And yeah, they actually brought all their Frontex forces to now kind of close the European border to the east. A lot of people actually managed, as you said before, to Lithuania. But as I heard of the situation, there's also not really welcoming. A lot of people are put in camps. The situation is really bad. And there were also several uprisings in the last month.
I think what is worth mentioning is that the people who are crossing the border to Lithuania or crossing the border to Poland, they're not going to those countries. They're going to Germany, they're going to France, they're going to the countries where they can get asylum.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome back to Off the Hour. This is CKUT. I'm Brian Jefferson, and you are just listening to a September 21st podcast from the producers Elephant in the Room. You can find more about them at -dresden.org, and you can find a new welcome guide for Montreal-based refugee claimants on the Facebook page for Collective Bienvenue. Before we leave you this hour, we'll give you some local news that you can use. The student-led community solidarity project Mobilizing for Milton Park is looking to recruit more volunteers for the new year. They give food and material support to unhoused Milton Park residents. You can find more information on their Instagram page at mobilizingformp. And the McCord Museum is offering free admission on Wednesday evenings after 5 p.m. The museum has now made their First Voices exhibit permanent. It's called Indigenous Voices of Today, Knowledge, Trauma, Resilience. And the march against the privatization of the old Royal Victoria Hospital building is happening this weekend. The building is near University and Penn, close to McGill's campus. It's organized by McGill students and starts at the Royal Vic site on Sunday at 2 p.m. And September 30th is the very first National Day of Truth and Reconciliation. Quebec as a province has chosen not to close workplaces or businesses on that day like some other provinces are doing. The Native Women's Shelter of Montreal and the Assembly of First Nations Quebec and Labrador organized a march and gathering on that day at Place du Canada. That's on Thursday at 1 p.m., and hosts are looking for volunteers to help. You can email Isabel Ruiz de la Orden to ask about how to get involved. They're at iruizdelaorden@gmail.com. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHourMTL or connect with us on Facebook. Just search for us through CKUT. And stay tuned for Cafe coming up next.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Bonsoir à tous et bienvenue à Café, votre émission d'art et culture du vendredi sur CKUT. Ici Ève Laurence au micro et j'ai l'honneur ce soir de vous présenter une œuvre musicale d'un artiste que l'on admire beaucoup ici à Café, James Carnes, du projet de Taxil Hoax, basé à Montréal. Alors pour la prochaine heure, vous allez pouvoir entendre une composition sous forme de mixtape qui rassemble plusieurs segments épars enregistrés par l'artiste au cours des deux dernières années. C'est souvent le défi auquel sont confrontés les artistes prolifiques. Et elle crée trop de bon matériel. Il compose beaucoup, il enregistre, mais des fois, c'est difficile d'utiliser ce matériel-là de manière cohérente sous forme d'album. Alors, plutôt que de sortir un album, The Taxil Hoax a opté pour un format qui permet la juxtaposition et l'enchaînement de segments pour créer une œuvre enivrante qui nous permet de vraiment se laisser aller, se laisser emporter et naviguer à travers différentes courtes chansons qui allient guitare et musique ambiante électronique. La mixtape s'intitule « Meditation on the UFO Phenomenon », ce qui révèle sa thématique, une thématique mystique, surnaturelle, sur l'inexplicable phénomène des objets volants non identifiés, les ovnis. Alors, James dit qu'il est devenu un peu nerd à propos de ce sujet-là. Il a fait énormément de lectures, consulté de la documentation, exploré même la pensée.